This is a Career Channel program from UC San Diego Extension. Visit us at www.uctv.tv/careers for videos, employment news, and trend articles to help recent college graduates and grads in career transition bridge to better employment.
Hello and welcome to The Pulse, Issues in Healthcare, the podcast where healthcare leaders share their thoughts on the issues of the day. This is Leslie Bruce, your host and the Director of Healthcare Leadership and Community Outreach for UC San Diego Extension. Today, I'm delighted to welcome Dr. Rick Kronick, a longtime professor with the Department of Family Medicine and Public Health at UC San Diego, with some pretty spectacular recent experience. Welcome, Rick.
Thank you, Leslie. It's great to be here.
I am thrilled to have you. So let's set the stage for that spectacular experience. In 2010, you took a multi-year leave from the university to take a presidential appointment as Deputy Assistant Secretary in the Office of the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, better known as ASPE. Mm-hmm. You were later appointed to head the Agency for Healthcare Research and Quality, and after 2.5 years there, just returned to San Diego, I might add. So here you have reached the very senior levels of government advocating for measures to improve healthcare and ultimately health in this country. What is a journey like that start?
I've taken a circuitous route to the positions that I had in the Obama administration. I started as a political scientist. I got a PhD from the University of Rochester and for a year taught in the government department at Harvard. I was teaching voting behavior and political socialization, and as well as statistics and econometrics. For a variety of reasons, it was not a very good year. And when I left that job, I wanted to stay in Cambridge. The one very good thing that happened that year is I met my now wife. We just celebrated our 35th wedding anniversary 2 nights ago, actually.
Congratulations.
Thank you. So I wanted to stay in Cambridge, and I got a job working at Apt Associates, which is a social science research place. And they had a lot of work from what was then called the Healthcare Financing Administration, now Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services. And they had a contract that was in trouble. It was about to get canceled. And they thought I could help them because I knew research design and data analysis. It was the first time I'd done anything in healthcare.
Oh, my gosh.
And I worked for them for 3 or 4 years. And then I, Mike Dukakis got elected governor in Massachusetts. I've always been interested in policy. I've got a sort of political orientation. And I got in touch with someone in the Executive Office of Human Services and said, you need somebody like me, and went to work in the Dukakis administration in a policy job and then for a couple of years in the Medicaid program.
How interesting. I like that you would just go in and say, you need somebody like me. I think we need to do that more in our lives, you know. We just wait for opportunity as opposed to going and grabbing it.
Yeah, you know, this was, getting into healthcare was accidental. We moved out to California in 1987 because my wife, who had been at Harvard for 8 years, got a job out here at UC San Diego. And I did not want to move. Dukakis was running for president. I was very well connected in Boston. San Diego obviously is a wonderful place to live, but I didn't know anybody out here. And the one part of the circuitous route that was pretty purposeful was that my wife, when I was grumbling, said, well, what do you want to be doing in 5 years? And I said, I wanted to be in a position where if there were a president who thought that healthcare reform was an important part of his or her agenda, that I would be one of the people that it might make sense to ask to come and work on it. And that was in 1988.
Wow.
And 5 years later, in 1993, I went to work for the Clinton administration on the Health Security Act.
My goodness. I mean, what an incredible journey, and seems like in rapid time, but it was over a period of years you established
yourself.
It
took quite a while, yes.
Making connections and all of that. And of course, I mean, I know we talk about Massachusetts as having been the first to basically adopt the Affordable Care Act, I mean, of their own, mm-hmm. as in a state level. And Michael Dukakis was instrumental in teeing that up. So I imagine you had a lot of fingerprints on that effort.
It's a long and twisted road from the legislation that was passed when Dukakis was governor to RomneyCare, but certainly every building block helped.
These are such amazing efforts and take so much perseverance and so much so much input and stakeholder review. So yes, I am sure it wasn't easy, and there's just a whole lot of elements to it. Well, I know that you were the Director of Policy and Reimbursement for the Medicaid Division of the Massachusetts Department of Public Welfare. What does that mean?
It means that I tried to figure out how Medicaid payment could be changed in ways that would improve the delivery of care to Medicaid beneficiaries. So we worked on early Medicaid managed care contracting. Mm. In 1987, 86, when I was doing that job, there was hardly any contracting between Medicaid agencies and HMOs. And Massachusetts Medicaid was starting to contract with various HMOs in the Boston area, and we worked on trying to figure out what should those contracts look like to try to get high-quality service to Medicaid beneficiaries. We worked on changes in how nursing homes were paid to try to make sure that nursing homes had the resources needed to take care of the Medicaid beneficiaries with the highest level of care, what was called risk-adjusted payments to nursing homes, and a variety of payment issues to try to figure out. I mean, a lot of the levers that Medicaid, the main lever that Medicaid has is payment. Mm-hmm. And so a lot of the work was figuring out how to change payment in ways that would improve care.
Well, it's noble goals to this day, that is for sure. So your wife brought you here to UC, or to San Diego, let's just say that.
Yes.
And then what happened?
When we got here, I was self-employed, slash not very well employed. I was a consultant to a variety of government agencies and a health insurer here or there. I did also finally, in 1990, finish a PhD that I had started in 1974. I didn't get my degree until 16 years after I started. I think the faculty of the University of Rochester had given up on me.
I bet they've all is forgiven.
I think so. I hope so. And then I did get in 1991, a job on the faculty here in the Department of what was then called Family and Preventive Medicine, or something like that.
Yes, right.
And I did that for a couple of years. And then when Bill Clinton was elected president said that healthcare reform was really important, I went to Washington as a senior health policy advisor, originally for 100 days. There was a sprint to get a health plan put together in 100 days, and there were 400 people working in a pretty chaotic process.
Wow.
But then ended up staying through Labor Day of 1994. So I was there for about 18 months on an unpaid leave of absence from the university.
Fascinating. And so then you came back.
Then I came back.
And what did you do then? What kind of work do you normally do here? Because, you know, you've been at the university a while, and what kinds of things did you work on here as a professor?
Well, as a faculty member in the medical school, I teach. Teach second-year medical students. It was a class called Introduction to the Healthcare System that I taught. Another faculty member started a master's program in the leadership of healthcare organizations and taught in that as well. Faculty members also do research, and I researched on the causes and consequences of lack of insurance. So why are so many people uninsured, and what can be done about it, and what difference does it make? Worked on both the causes and consequences part of that. The causes are, you know, pretty clear. We don't have a financing system that makes it possible for lots of low-income people to get insurance. the consequences are clear in some ways. People get much less health care when they're uninsured. They suffer financial catastrophes. The health consequences are harder to tease out, and I did a lot of work on trying to understand that as well. I also have done a lot of work on risk-adjusted payments to HMOs. Mm-hmm. So, prior to 20 years ago, HMOs got paid pretty much the same for everybody who enrolled. And since some of us need a lot more health care than others, mm-hmm. that makes a health plan very unhappy to see a sick person come in the door, and makes it hard to develop systems of care that are going to be really responsive to people most in need. Mm-hmm. The sort of iconic story here, which may or may not be true, is that when the AIDS epidemic hit the Bay Area in the early 80s, that the infectious disease doctors at Kaiser very quickly figured out that they could take much better care, which meant they could help their patients die more with more dignity, because at the time there was nothing to
be
done.
No options, yeah.
If they connected with the social service agencies in the Bay Area that were active in gay rights and taking care of men with AIDS. And they even made a pretty good case that it would reduce costs for the health plan by doing so, because it would keep people out of the hospital. But the health plan leadership, understandably, was nervous about getting a reputation as being the best place in the Bay Area to be if you have AIDS, because mm-hmm. it would put them out of business.
I see.
And that's crazy.
Right, right.
And so I and others have worked on risk-adjusted payment systems that pay health plans more when they take sick people and less than when they take healthy people. Sounds easy to describe, but actually surprisingly hard to actually implement in ways that work.
And worthwhile yet. So I yes. hope it's still going on.
We're still working on that, yes.
Excellent. Well, that's good to hear. And so you were working here a number of years, and some of those things that you were working on were grant-funded?
Yes, much of my work mm-hmm. Is grant-funded. Most faculty in the med school, some people get some state money, and I'm fortunate to have some state support, mm-hmm. but much of my salary is funded by grants, some of it from the federal government, but much of my grant funding was from philanthropic organizations, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, the mm-hmm. California Healthcare Foundation, the Commonwealth Fund. Places like that.
Well, they are certainly doing wonderful work. So that brings us to the point where you get this appointment. And how did that come about? How did you get the call or whatever it was to go back to Washington and work at ASPE?
Sherry Gleed, who was the Assistant Secretary for Planning and Evaluation, and is someone I've known for many years, asked if I would be interested in being the Deputy Assistant Secretary for Health Policy. Mm-hmm. The Affordable Care Act was being discussed. This was in the fall of 2009. And I could not have imagined a more exciting way to spend time and energy. My wife and I had just moved from the house in Carmel Valley that we brought our two daughters up in to a townhouse condo in La Jolla, a kind of empty nest place. Mm-hmm. And when Sherry asked, was I interested in this, my first reaction was, sounds great. But we had just spent a lot of energy on this move. But my Amy was incredibly supportive and said, of course you have to talk with her about doing this. Mm-hmm. And so in January of 2010, we moved to D.C. In theory for 2 years. The university gave me a 2-year leave of absence.
Mm-hmm. In theory. And
yes.
Then what happened?
It was a fantastic job. Mm-hmm. I managed a group of about 20 people initially, growing to about 40, working on a variety of things. Probably the most exciting part was trying to figure out how to implement the coverage expansion parts of the Affordable Care Act. Mm-hmm. In 2010, there wasn't much, there was hardly anybody around whose job it was to try to implement the health insurance exchanges. And there was a lot of work that needed to be done to figure out what the policy should be, writing regulations, estimating the effects of these regulations. Eventually, in CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, there was established a group called CSIO, the Center for Consumer Information and Insurance Oversight, which does all this. Mm-hmm. But in early 2010, even into 2011, there needed a lot of help. And the group of people that I managed, mostly social scientists, some physicians, were very smart, good analysts, some very good regulation writers. And we worked on trying to figure out how to make all this work. Mm-hmm. We also worked on public relations parts of trying to, there was a lot of criticism that the Affordable Care Act was going to make premiums skyrocket and cause costs to go out of control and cause employers to drop insurance. And the social science analysts who were working for me were ideally suited to try to assess the truth of these arguments. And we put out many, many issue briefs trying to explain what was going on. Many of these issue briefs were on the front page of the New York Times, the Washington Post. Some of them were used actually by the Department of Justice in the briefs that went for the Supreme Court case challenging the constitutionality of the individual mandate. So a lot of very exciting work there, as well as work on Medicare payment policy. So, the people at Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services at CMS have the responsibility for making proposals around Medicare payment policy. But at ASPE, we did quite a lot of work in a variety of areas with our colleagues at CMS, analytic work, trying to figure out what made sense. So it was a very exciting place to be. I asked the university for an extension of my leave of absence, initially a one-year extension, which they granted, and then another two-year extension, which they granted.
Well, that was nice. I think they appreciated the effort you were making and the contribution, quite honestly, because it's pretty darn remarkable, and we're lucky to have you back, frankly, I think. I think it's a very addictive atmosphere there to be able to make contributions like you're making. I know when I bring students to Washington, they all want to be part of it. They are just thrilled with the energy, the commitment, the dedication, the meaningfulness of the effort. And I was going to ask you, in fact, you talk about working in that environment. And I know initially you were working 24/7 because the dates hadn't changed in the legislation that said you had to have regs by a certain time, and you were all working, copious hours. What was that like?
It was tiring, and I'm getting to be an old man, but the adrenaline was certainly there, and the support was there. We were part of a large team of people working towards this goal. And as in any large team, there are a few difficult people to work with, but it was mostly an extremely collaborative and collegial environment that was created by Kathleen Sebelius, the secretary, and Bill Kaur, the deputy secretary. It made the long hours rewarding and worthwhile.
What we all want, right?
Yeah. I mean, there are, many wonderful aspects of university life. You get to actually think about problems in depth, figure out what's really important, or try to at least. Mm-hmm. You've got the time and energy and freedom to write. I appreciate those aspects tremendously. Really diametrically opposed in many ways to working in the government. In academia, we are rewarded for what we figure out on our own, the brilliant man or woman.
Individual, for sure.
In government, you can't do anything on your own.
Right.
Anything that gets done is done in a team. Mm-hmm. And that can be extremely frustrating because the other team members don't understand this is the way it should be done. but also is very rewarding and supportive.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what a perfect combination to have both of those things, because, you know, we're so far from power here in San Diego that I think it's especially exhilarating to go and see government in action. And frankly, to see the caliber of people that are there working on these problems is pretty incredible also.
There are, yes, lots of very dedicated and smart people, both the politicals that get brought in, and even more, many of the career staff.
Mm-hmm,
You know, the other side is you're very far away from actually being able to change how healthcare is delivered, which gets done on the ground. That's what's done in San Diego.
That's so interesting.
You know, figuring out how to make healthcare safer and higher quality. Well, when you're in Washington or in Rockville, as I was at AHRQ, we can try to put in place, try to create an environment in which that will get done, but we don't do it. It's people at the medical center here and my clinical colleagues who are working on making that happen.
That's so interesting. That's a very good point. And it does bring us to ARC, AHRQ, that you were appointed to, several $100 million agency whose mission is to produce evidence to make healthcare safer, higher quality, more accessible, equitable, and affordable, and to work within the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and with other partners to make sure the evidence is understood and used. That's the official mission of AHRQ, and I thought that was very interesting. And I noticed that one blogger summarized it as, quote, helping guide the practice of medicine. Do you agree with that characterization of AHRQ?
I wouldn't say guide the practice of medicine as much as produce evidence that can be used by clinicians and patients and policymakers, both at the health system level and the government level, to produce evidence about what works and what doesn't work, how the organization of healthcare can be improved, how healthcare can be made safer. So a very important part of what ARC does is produce evidence. But evidence in and of itself doesn't do anything to make healthcare better. Mm-hmm. The evidence has got to be understood and used.
Right.
And ARC is a relatively small agency, about 300 staff, $430 million of annual revenue, which for a research agency is decent size.
Yeah.
But as part of a health system in the United States that's $3 trillion and 800,000 physicians and 5,000 hospitals and 330 million patients is very small. And so the understood and used part of the mission is, you know, very important, and one that I worked hard to try to make sure that the staff at ARC, who are very talented and who are primarily researchers, would focus on the need to develop partnerships both within the government and outside to try to make sure that that evidence is understood and used.
Right, and that's out on the ground, like you were just talking about, that it's implemented on the ground.
Yeah. And then the third part of what the agency does, so the first part is the production of evidence, second part is the understood and used and the creation of tools to make it easy to do that, and the third part is investment in data and measures to be able to figure out how we're doing. The old, you know, you can't manage what you don't measure. Well, measurement is a big problem here.
Well, we're moving along with electronic medical records. Is that a big improvement in our ability with respect to this data and measurement?
It has the potential, but we are early enough on that it is still largely potential. And turning that potential into reality is going to take, I think, many decades probably of work.
Okay. What do you think AHRQ's most significant contributions to improving health have been?
I think the most significant contributions have been in the area of improving the safety of care, particularly of care delivered in hospitals. So from 2010 to 2014, care in hospitals got 17% safer.
Wow.
What that means is that in 2010, for every 1,000 patients who were hospitalized, there were 145 adverse events. Adverse events are things like central line infections, catheter-associated urinary tract infections, but also falls, mm-hmm. pressure ulcers, adverse drug events. That measurement of 145 bad things per thousand is looking at 28 different kinds of adverse events. There are actually more adverse events that aren't measured, but that was where the mm-hmm. measurement comes from. That 145 per thousand in 2010 was reduced to 121 per thousand mm-hmm. in 2014, which is still way too many, but is a cumulative 2.1 million fewer harms to patients over that four-year period.
That's a lot.
With an estimated 87,000 fewer deaths over the four-year period and about $20 billion in cost savings. So very substantial progress.
Absolutely.
Important question is, well, why did this occur? Mm-hmm. And what do we need to do to keep,
right.
Keep that progress moving? And I can't give you a definitive answer to that, but I can give you some answers that I think are right.
Okay.
Part of that progress was, an important part of the progress was the existence of evidence about how to make healthcare safer. And AHRQ funded 15 years ago a researcher at Johns Hopkins, Peter Pronovost, who did work in hospitals in Michigan, showing that central line infections could basically be eliminated. Central line infections, when patients are in the ICU, some of them get a catheter inserted into their heart, central line.
Mm-hmm, yes.
And those catheters, those lines can get infected. And if they do, the mortality rate is very high. And before the work that Peter Pronovost did, residents in their training just learned that, well, central lines are a cost of doing business in the ICU. It's just kind of part of what happens.
Oh, boy.
And Pronovost showed, actually, it didn't need to just happen. And some fairly simple checklist approaches to making this safer
infection prevention
could pretty much get rid of them. Mm-hmm. So ARC funded that and other research to show how to make healthcare safer.
Mm-hmm.
And that's good, but again, in and of itself, doesn't do the job. Mm-hmm. That evidence needs to get understood and used. And ARC funded a project called CUSP, the Central Unit-Based Safety Program, I think, that worked in over 1,000 ICUs around the country to try to get this evidence really implemented.
Mm-hmm.
And then subsequent to that, CMS, the Center for Medicare and Medicaid Services, through the Partnership for Patients program, has provided technical assistance to 80% of the hospitals around the country on how to make healthcare safer. And that work, I think, was made, the success of those efforts were increased by changes in Medicare payment systems. So Medicare, as part of the Affordable Care Act, implemented the HACRP, the Hospital Acquired Condition Reduction Program, which penalizes hospitals that have high rates of hospital-acquired conditions. And that program, I think, helped get the attention of CEOs and CFOs so that the work of improving safety wasn't only the job of the quality and safety officer, who in many hospitals can be somewhat marginalized.
Indeed.
So a combination of having evidence about how to make healthcare safer,
mm-hmm.
providing the technical assistance to get that evidence implemented, and then changes in the payment system that got the attention of senior leadership,
right.
Has facilitated this really remarkable improvement. Mm-hmm. And again, 121 adverse events per thousand is not good. That's
right.
Still a lot of
still too
harms.
Many. Sure.
But we have made very substantial progress, and the work that ARC has done has been integral to that progress on all three dimensions, and ARC's work also the investment that ARC has made has allowed us to measure this. We wouldn't know what the story was without the investments that ARC has made in data and measures.
Well, given all that ARC has done, you talk about 87,000 lives saved and billions of dollars. Why have House Republicans been eager to eliminate funding for the agency?
You would need to ask them to get a really definitive answer. I don't really want to speculate on motivations. The criticisms that we have heard in public are that ARC does really important work, but other agencies do pieces of that work, and we don't need a separate agency. Mm. And it is certainly true that there are other agencies involved in trying to improve safety, and other agencies involved, the National Institutes of Health, in trying to produce evidence about how care can be improved. Mm-hmm. But ARC is the only agency that's devoted full time mm-hmm. to trying to figure out how the delivery system can be improved, how the delivery of healthcare can be improved. And I guess I would make an analogy here to the national defense. The Air Force isn't the only branch of the military that has airplanes.
Very true.
But we don't say, well, we don't need the Air Force because other people have airplanes. Mm-hmm. We need a part of the military that's devoted to air power. And we need an agency that is devoted to improving safety and quality of healthcare. I think also that as a small agency, we have had a hard time making sure that people understand what we've done. And for some people, there may be an association of the agency with healthcare reform, with the Affordable Care Act, although that association is not is not one that makes sense to me. I mean, the agency has not been much involved in the coverage expansion parts of healthcare reform. The agency has been involved in the delivery system reform effort that the Health and Human Services more broadly has been working on, but that's a bipartisan kind of approach.
Sure, sure. Well, I must say I did get a kick. I read that Gerald Kaminsky, do you know who he is?
Yes.
That he's the director for the Center for Health Policy Research at UCLA, said he thought that this effort to eliminate funding for the agency was because of the idea that we don't want government placing any sort of restrictions on our ability to buy healthcare services, even if they have no proven quality. And I just thought, wow, what an interesting thing that says about us, that we want to be able to buy healthcare services even if they have no proven quality. I think we're...
Professor Kaminsky is a close friend of mine, and he's a brilliant guy. I think disagree with him on that. I don't think that's a big part of the motivation I think the bigger part probably is, there is a desire to make government smaller, and that this was an agency that, as a pretty small agency, there was some thought that maybe we can just get rid of it and no one will care.
Right.
It was very heartening to see the strength of support.
I was just going to ask you about that. As a matter of fact,
hundreds of professional societies,
perfect,
hospital associations, insurers, as well as the support that came from the administration, from my boss, Secretary Burwell, and from folks at the White House. So there was a lot of pushback. The House had voted, the House Appropriations Committee voted last June to zero out the agency. The Senate Appropriations Committee voted a 35% cut. And so, there was some thought that, we would end up somewhere in between. Mm-hmm. We ended up with an 8% cut, which was extremely painful. And
I'm sure.
The person responsible for making decisions about that cut, it was very, very difficult. But, much better than what many people feared. And I think that outcome is a testimony to the strength of support that came for the agency.
And I think it's remarkable and absolutely wonderful, and I'm sure there were steps that you took, when these conversations were taking place in Congress, to educate I won't say advocate, but to educate people about the value of what you were doing there, and certainly that the staff as well. Were there any particular steps you took? I mean, was there a campaign to go out and change the opinion of the folks in charge of the purse strings?
As you point out, as a federal employee, I would certainly not advocate for the agency, but I did spend a lot of energy in education. Mm-hmm. And a lot of that energy was around trying to sharpen the message. So mm-hmm. what do? We do three things. We produce evidence. We invest in tools and training to try to make sure the evidence is understood and used. And we invest in data and measures to be able to understand what's going on. And there is no better example of the results of that work than the work that we've done to improve the safety of hospital care, mm-hmm, with the mm-hmm. result that 87,000 lives have been saved over the 2010 to 2014 period.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. Well, I think that certainly is persuasive. So what do you think?
I'm glad I've got your vote.
Anytime. So what do you think we need to do as a country now in both, you know, the short term and the long term to improve quality of care?
We need to finish the job of the coverage expansion that mm-hmm. has started. So, you know, there are still more than a handful of states that have not expanded Medicaid. With really dire consequences for low-income people in those states, as well as for the hospitals and providers. But I would focus more on the consequences for people mm-hmm. who are uncovered, mm-hmm. as well as fix a variety of other problems and glitches in the Affordable Care Act to increase coverage for people who are eligible for exchanges, for subsidies in the marketplaces. So, you know, we've made tremendous progress in the last 6 years on coverage. 20 million more people have
Isn't
health insurance
amazing?
Than would have had it. And that is a wonderful outcome. We need also to increase the value that we put on primary care. Mm. Primary care physicians, and I should preface this by saying I'm in the Department of Family Medicine and Public Health, so this is somewhat self-serving, but even if I were not in that department, primary care physicians, as well as primary care nurse practitioners and physician assistants, are paid much less than or earn much less than specialists. It's a job in which satisfaction is, for some people, tough to find because mm-hmm. they're on the hamster wheel and a lot of mm-hmm. requirements for producing information. Quality and outcomes would be greatly improved if we put more value on primary care and made the job of primary care clinicians a better job. Mm-hmm. We need also to be putting more emphasis in public health. Mm-hmm. Much of what determines how healthy or sick we are goes on outside of the physician's office. We have put very few resources into public health. The one partial success we've had in the main partial success in public health is the decline in smoking mm-hmm. that we've seen over the last 20 years, although mm-hmm. certainly still a problem. But we have an enormous problem with obesity, problems with air quality and asthma for low-income children. Mm-hmm. So more resources going into public health would improve the quality of healthcare, the outcomes that we achieve.
Very helpful. I think those are some excellent ideas, and I'm heartened by the work you've done and these thoughts. And I'm wondering, are you still doing work for ARC?
Uh-huh. I am 2 days a week working for HRQ on some research projects that were started when I was there. Bit of that work will be published next week in JAMA as a viewpoint on the patient safety work that I discussed, talking about the improvements of safety in hospitals. I'm very pleased about that with some ARC co-authors. But the main work I'm doing there is on projects trying to better understand what health systems are in the United States and how they are performing. Increasingly, care is being delivered by systems.
Systems, you bet.
But if you ask me for a list of the health systems, I actually can't give you one. We don't have any. It's not like the hospitals where I can give you a list of the 5,000 hospitals in the country or of the 800,000 physicians. But can I give you a list of health systems? No. Can I tell you how they're doing? Not really. And we have started some work internally at ARC, as well as funding three grantees externally to try to make progress on that problem. And I will continue to work on that.
Well, we'll have you back and talk about it when you have something to tell us.
I look forward to
Absolutely.
It.
Absolutely. Well, so you've got the wonderful work you're still doing with ARC on your plate. Will there be anything you're doing specifically UCSD that isn't part of that?
I am sure there will. I've only been back for a couple months, and I'm still trying to figure that part out. I know that I'll be back to teaching, and I'm looking forward to that a lot.
Oh, yeah.
But on the research side, still working on figuring that out.
Well, I'm sure it'll be wonderful, and I hope you'll keep me posted, because I would love to hear about it. Last question. Hillary Clinton, as you know, has just been... is now considered the presumptive nominee for the Democratic Party in this upcoming presidential race. And you have certainly worked with her on health care issues in the past, as you mentioned earlier. What happens, would you be inclined to go back to Washington if the call were to come?
Leslie, I've been back in San Diego now for barely 3 months, and I'm greatly enjoying all that San Diego has to offer.
It's pretty great, I have to say.
And answering hypotheticals usually just gets a person into trouble, especially if their wife is listening to the podcast.
I understand completely. Well, on that note, I want to thank you again for joining me. It's been a real pleasure, and we're glad to have you back in San Diego.
Thank you so much. It's been great.
And I want to thank our listeners and ask them, if you want to be notified of future podcasts, to share your email address with us at extension.ucsd.edu. Also, I am more than interested in your suggestions, listeners, for guests you'd like to hear. So send me an email at careerchannel, all one word, at ucsd.edu. Until next time, this is Leslie Bruce saying here's to your health.